Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Mark Baldino, co-founder of Fuzzy Math, and we're going to talk about the ROI of user experience. This episode is brought to you by UserList, a lifecycle messaging tool for your SaaS product. At UserList, our mission is to make your founder journey more enjoyable and less overwhelming. That's why we built an email automation tool that does exactly what you need, no more, no less. Manage your users, segment them, and get in touch throughout their journey, all based on their behavior. Try UserList free whenever you're ready at userlist.com. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Jane. How are you?
Thanks. Doing great. We're excited to have you on board and all your wisdom and knowledge and experience.
Hopefully, I can provide some of that. You've set the bar high.
Tell us more about what you do and your amazing, super experienced agency in Chicago.
Yeah, of course. So I'm the co-founder of Fuzzy Math. We are a user experience design consultancy. We're based in Chicago, clients, you know, across North America and worldwide. You know, we're really focused niche on user experience design. I've been in UX and user-centered design for 20 plus years. I've worked for a lot of larger companies, larger software companies, enterprise organizations. And so when Ben and I decided to Ben's my co-founder decided to, you know, start Fuzzy Math, it was really about this focus of the power of smaller teams within bigger organizations. And just because we'd seen that experience. And so, you know, the second component of that was staying true to ourselves, which was that we were designers and user experience designers. And so kind of built an agency that focuses squarely on providing UX, but primarily in the B2B and enterprise world. And that allows us, you know, we think to bring consumer grade design and the expectation of consumer-grade design to the business world. We see a lot of our clients, end users, are using software that looks and feels outdated, is ineffective, inefficient, big usability problems. But because it's the business world, those companies haven't put enough time, effort into the design and usability. And so that's where we come to play, which is to bring our craft into the enterprise and B2B space.
You've been super focused on just delivering the UX and design aspect of work and not doing development, which I can just give you massive kudos for. How hard is it to stay so focused?
It's really, really, really hard because sometimes a project will come across our inbox that is a great fit, but they want full service. They have technology in mind and they want the great design to serve that. But we believe that the core focus of being user-centered is that you're putting the user at the center of the process. And when you're engineering-led or technology-led, or you have a technology perspective as an agency, you're inevitably going to cloud your judgment of what products and services from a technical perspective that you recommend. And as an agency, we want to stay true to the end user. And frankly, they don't care what the e-commerce or content management system is at the, you know, underpinning all of this. They want an experience that advocates for them, that meets their needs, that meets them where they are now and where they want to be. And so that's why we decided not to build the technical capability in-house so that we could be agnostic to the technology and really be solely focused on the end user at the end of the day. But it means we also have to stay abreast of technology and different technologies because we work alongside engineers all the time. All of our work gets built at the end of the day, right? Somebody's going to take and consume our design work and actually build it. And so we can't do our work in a vacuum. And in fact, we found the most success that while we're independent as an agency and solely focused on the kind of niche of user experience design, we have the best success when we're working alongside a technical team that can help validate and vet some of our ideas, but that as much as they might push back from a technical perspective, we push back from a user perspective and say, this is what your user needs or this is what your user demands. And so it really becomes a much healthier conversation. And I find that agencies that are more full service, they probably started with technology and added design at the end of, you know, later on in their history. And that technology wins a lot of those conversations. And we always feel like design and the user should be winning those conversations.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
I know you share that viewpoint.
We have talked about enterprise UX here in the podcast before, and I'd like to link to episode 164 with Rakesh Patwari in case our listeners are interested. Before we dive into the ROI aspect, what are the main challenges of your work as enterprise UX consultants? Because your goal is to bring the polish of B2C to B2B, which is a challenge, of course.
I mean, the biggest challenge is that when people think B2C or consumer grade design, they're just thinking about the polish. But, you know, we consider ourselves master craftspersons of a much more holistic process. And so the biggest challenge is that they don't necessarily want to undertake the investment in reworking their tool from a usability perspective and a workflow perspective and an information design perspective. All of the foundational sort of product strategy work we do, which involves, you know, primary research, really traditional UX methodologies, right? That all sets a foundation all before we actually get to the UI at the end of the day. But people are always looking at that UI and they're always thinking, when are we going to get to the UI? When are we going to get to the UI? And so when we're working with enterprises in particular, there's sort of a number of areas and challenges that we face. The first is patience. So it's the first P is patience. They have to be patient with the process, right? They have to allow us to run it. And that means we have to find maybe the right client or the organization at the right time in their evolution that they're willing to be a little bit more patient. If they want to rush you out to the UI, we're not going to get there. The second is partnerships. So when we're working within the enterprise, we have to establish a partnership either with an internal design team or with their product group, maybe with technologists, but it has to be really a collective sort of process where we're not working independently as an agency because we'll get swallowed by an enormous sort of enterprise. And the last challenge we run into, I kind of call the philosophy of change. It's the third P there. People tend to look at a scope of work or a project and everyone's focused on the timeline, right? They're all saying time is the most important thing. Time, 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 faster, faster, faster. That goes back to the patient component. But the true problem within organizations is their philosophy of change. They're unwilling to embrace change within their organization. And so we work hard just on that component, which is we're not just moving pixels here. We are changing the way that your organization or your enterprise looks at, speaks, and understands your end users. And that's going to influence everything you do moving forward. It's going to influence customer service, how your product team creates a feature set, how your engineers develop. Pull an engineer into research and it'll change how they develop at the end of the day. So it's all about this philosophy of change. And that is a challenge, but it's a fun one because when we're moving the right needles, and I know we'll get into ROI in a bit, but when we're moving the right needles at an enterprise software company, we are impacting thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of end users at the end of the day. And that's like a really exciting challenge.
Just curious, you have over 20 people on your team?
Just about 20.
And so which part of that in percentage does that delightful like pixel pushing, like that visual layer of the design?
It's actually just about a quarter of the company. So three quarters, and that actually probably balances out to what a project would look like, right? You were going there before I got there, which is about, you know, a half to three quarters of our work is before we get to the final pixels. It's research, it's information design, it's low fidelity design. And that's kind of our UX team. And then the final component, which is around brand look and feel and pixel perfect, is that final quarter or a third of a project.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing the details of your internal process. And now let's talk about ROI, the metrics and how to measure, which is a mystery to myself at large and to many of our listeners, because it's super hard to get access to metrics. Most of the companies don't have proper metrics set up. And then how do you even measure that mysterious user satisfaction if with numbers at all? So what's your approach?
Well, it's another challenge, right? You're right. A lot of people don't have their data set up correctly or their metrics set up correctly. Sometimes in a consumer-facing world, they will have data and analytics, conversion rates, time on site, you know, something you'd find in like a Google Analytics suite. But that is a far cry from actually measuring overall user success. And so when we're working in the B2B and enterprise world, a lot of those that metrics, that they don't actually make sense, right? There isn't a conversion rate. Time on site isn't a useful metric. So what we do, and we do this early on in the process, and we do workshops just around establishing metrics and what we want to measure from an ROI perspective. And it is understanding what our clients have. And we find that our clients are generally tracking KPIs at a very high level, at the very least, which is, you know, revenue, maybe how many of their clients are renewing, what are those conversion rates? If it's a SaaS-based platform, they might have something kind of from a funnel and a conversion perspective. So those are all tied to high-level dollars, right? How much is the company growing? What's our margin? Those are really important, but they certainly don't tell you anything about user satisfaction. And so we come down one level to what we would consider like customer satisfaction, which might be measured with something like Net Promoter Score. Now, NPS is you know, a method. It's really a referral. Would you recommend this product or service to someone else? And it's one way to gather how happy somebody is with a company overall as a customer. But that could include online experiences, offline experiences, customer support, maybe even sales. Again, that's one level closer to the user, but it's not the base level. So we help our clients go one level final deeper, which is around measuring user satisfaction. And the way we do this, it isn't that complicated. It involves research. And so we use a series of tools to measure user satisfaction, but it's through surveys. And so what we're trying to do is create almost a pulse of the user's satisfaction with a product or service while they're using it. And so we establish a baseline as early as we can. And it is around how satisfied they are using the software. So actual core satisfaction metric, and then how efficient the software is. So we're measuring two components there. And when we can establish that as an internal baseline before we've done any of our work, we can then take that pulse on a regular basis. Many of our clients are doing it, if they have enough volume, every month. If not as much volume, they'll do it every quarter. But what we can do is by establishing the baseline on day zero, in one quarter, we measure it. And we look at all the work we've done from a design and engineering and implementation. What have we changed within the tool? Has that translated to an increase in user satisfaction? And then maybe we're able to tie that back up to something like NPS. Has NPS and a higher customer satisfaction shifted over time? Well, now we have two comparable metrics that are reported on a quarterly basis. And we know that people in the C-suite and executives are looking at quarterly reports, right? They're always looking these 90-day outs. They're always looking 90 days out. They probably maybe have a dashboard of financial metrics. If we can get our data into those dashboards that says your user satisfaction is shifting in these ways over time on a quarterly basis, we can now compare that to where I started, which was some of the company financials. So it's a long tail because companies are generally starting at a set of numbers that are difficult to connect down to user satisfaction. But we have to start taking the pulse of those users, and then we have a comparable metric and we can gauge all the changes we're making along the way.
Are you ever serving the same user more than once? Or is it about, let's say, having an influx of new users and analyzing their experience?
That's a great question. We can survey the same user over time, but we don't necessarily need to. We are looking for a representative sample of users. And that could be the same user gets queried two quarters in a row, or maybe you get queried once and then not for 2 years. It's more about an aggregate that we're looking for. So we're looking for more quantitative. A lot of the research we do as UX designers is qualitative, kind of some of the more fun research when we're just having conversations with people, doing ethnography. But this is one of the areas where we sort of lean into the data and the quant, and we just want a representative sample. For one of our clients right now, we're actually measuring new user. We're doing a segmentation of the satisfaction of new users versus existing users. So we can pull it out and then have a comparable. Are we moving the needle more for new users versus existing users? Because a lot of people looking for growth, right? Maybe their current user population is an older demographic and they want to shift to a younger demographic. So we've updated the design and some of the features, functionality. Now let's actually get a pulse of that demographic shift or that new versus old shift and see if we're moving the needle in comparable groups.
Which leads to another question, which is, do you segment your users which are being surveyed by their life cycle stage? So do you get people who are barely activated or folks who are like a few months mature into the product?
Yes. So the answer to that simple is yes. We do want to understand people who are brand new. Thank you for the leading questions because you're thinking where our minds are and what we're advising to our clients is we do want a blend of people who just started to use the tool, you know, and then people who've been using it for a while. A lot of times, you know, one of the challenge of doing research in general is humans are complicated. They didn't get into this at the start. The reason fuzzy math, my agency is called fuzzy math is because the fuzzy side is like the human psychology of what we do, because humans are inherently hard to understand. And sometimes they say one thing and they do another. And that's very confusing from a research perspective. You don't know how to make sense of that. The math side of the fuzzy math is really like kind of the robust process we apply, some of the data and analytics, but it's just that we have this repeatable process that we can apply to help us understand kind of the human psychology. And one of the areas that our clients struggle with is, you know, during the sales process, people say, I want to use these 15 features. And then they start using software and they use two of them. And then when they comes up for, let's say, a renewal, they don't renew because they've only used two of the features when they said they wanted 15. And so we're trying to dissect that. And that initial component, when somebody starts using a tool, it's important to understand their satisfaction, because if that's low, then you have an enormous problem. They're not going to become repeat users, most likely, of your tool. They're not going to increase the set of features that they use. They're not going to renewal. They're not going to renew at the end of the day, and they're not going to refer your product out to other people, which is how a lot of sort of growth in the software business, you know, is achieved.
These are all great aspects, because the common recommendation is like, well, the general one is like, talk to your users, couldn't be more vague. And then it's like, you can talk to them in person, you can survey them, and it's like, survey users. But who do you survey? When do you survey them? And now the most interesting part, how? So could you share your methodology, what kind of questions you're asking, how you're collecting answers, what software do you use?
Yes. So we base our surveys, and the technology is dependent on the platform. So it's usually served internally from the client's software, or there's third party. But we use a tool called SuperQ. And SuperQ is a set of standard questions. It actually stands for the Standardized User Experience Percentile Rank Questionnaire. That's very confusing. So we say SuperQ. This is a set of six questions around usability that we ask users on a regular basis. Are you likely to return? Was it easy to navigate? Do you find the information trustworthy and credible? You know, do you find the design to be attractive? And then we ask an NPS type question, which is, you know, would you refer and recommend this software to someone else? And what we get out of SuperQ is that standard set of questions, and then it gives you a SuperQ score. And it's a score from 0 to 100. It's not that important whether you're at a 10 or you're at a 90. Yes, higher is better. But for us, it's really about establishing that user satisfaction metric as a baseline. And then we ask a question around sort of efficiency gains, because I think it's a second important component. So not just how happy are you, but is this product increasing your productivity or increasing your efficiency? Because we work primarily in the B2B and enterprise world, that's a really helpful gauge. Maybe in a consumer-facing world, that, you know, an e-commerce site, that might not make the most sense. But for our clients, we are always trying to improve efficiency. I mean, when don't you want a tool to improve your efficiency? And when people measure time on site or how many pages somebody visited, or we get a lot of requests, we say, hey, this workflow takes 10 steps and 15 clicks. We want to get it down to one page and two clicks. That might be a worse experience. You might be actually creating problems by shrinking it down to one page. So we want to measure the perception of improved sort of efficiency gains. And actually that goes closer to what is kind of what people call an experience level agreement, an XLA. I don't know how many people are familiar with this. A lot of software companies have service level agreements, which are an SLA. It's an agreement around how it involves some around like uptime and software availability, but how quickly people are going to respond to support requests and kind of overall stability and customer support. And that's okay. We look at customer support metrics, you know, call center times and ticket requests, but an XLA is really about measuring the experience. And so it's an experience level agreement that you can establish between, you know, software vendors and their end users, or if you're delivering software internally to your enterprise of internal users, you have an XLA agreement. And that XLA generally has, you know, two questions, the user satisfaction and kind of increased efficiency. And so between SuperQ and wrapping it up into the sort of XLA component, that gives us our series of questions that we ask on sort of this longitudinal regular basis.
I'm so glad you're touching upon those, you know, page views and mouse clicks and everything, because a ton of modern analytics tools or other tools, because I'm co-founder of UserList and we do deal with user behavior data. And a lot of these one-click installations, they measure like button clicks and page views, and this is like nowhere close to like actual product usage. You mentioned that, for example, I don't know, some certain product usage metrics are not good enough, but what about page clicks? That's even worse. That's like, that's non-indicative at all, right?
Right. 100%. And I think it's an outdated way of thinking, or it's a way of how the media industry, you know, built itself. It's all about page views, page views, page views, or reducing clicks because we assume clicks are bad. But what's to say that a two-page process is better than a one longer page process? I mean, so some people are pushing, oh, we're going to get this down to one page and it's that's going to be more efficient. And other people are breaking it apart. I don't have the answer. It depends on who your users are and what do they need. We do plenty of work with physicians in hospitals or people on factory floors. They don't want a lot of screens and they don't want lots of white space, which is, you know, modern design has big fonts and lots of white space. Well, if I'm on a shop floor and I have a tablet in front of me, guess what I don't want? I don't want to be clicking around and I don't want white space. Data density actually helps me make decisions. You know, if you look at Bloomberg terminals, they're data density. Why? Not because people want that experience, but because they need a rich information set in front of them to inform decision making. And you can get that in any type of job. And so it's more subtle than just saying, hey, we want more white space, or let's get this down to one click from 10. No, let's look at the workflow. Let's study it and let's build it, you know, take it apart and build it back up. And then let's measure whether this has increased the, you know, effectiveness and efficiency of the process, as opposed to kind of counting arbitrary numbers here or there.
I'm so glad you mentioned the white space problem, because it's been a recurring theme here on the show that we talked about different industry and applications that, for example, in medical software, you don't want like multiple screens. In dashboards, you don't want everything removed because then the data doesn't make any sense to some users. So
yes,
absolutely.
Yes. I think business users in particular, you know, in dashboards, they want that data density and they're used to it and they're comfortable with it. And I think sometimes it scares designers because they see all this information and all they want to do is sort of push it and spread it out. But that actually decreases the effectiveness of that software.
Let's talk about auditing individual features. You mentioned that example of two features versus 15 features. So how do you measure feature usage in actual numbers across the user base for your client products? And how do you translate those numbers into actual user success? Because it can be very, very different for different types of users.
I mean, if I owned another company, it would be measuring like feature usage inside of tools. It'd be a software platform, because I get the question. I get the question all the time. And a lot of tools, you know, you get into the signed in experience of a piece of software, and they have no metrics whatsoever, no usage statistics, no feature usage. So when they have that information, I do find it useful, which because it compares that in sales, we were told people would use this, or on our website, people are saying that they're interested in these features, but in usage, they're not actually using them. And so there is a sense of, can we measure how often somebody is using a feature? And that has to be done with some internal analytics tool that isn't our responsibility and sometimes isn't there. So if we don't have that data, we're asking people during user research. But when we have the data, we then can compare it to the satisfaction score. And I think that's what's helpful. Maybe I can't say that this specific feature is making them happier, but if I have that data, it's another layer deeper into the tool of feature usage. And if I can compare that to a user satisfaction metric on an ongoing basis, or I can segment out people that are using this group of features have this satisfaction versus this group of features, we can start to tell a picture of feature kind of effectiveness, but it's a really, really hard thing to do.
When it comes to survey analysis, for example, you typically don't have the time or resources to analyze every single response when it's like full text, but there are some edge cases that you need to analyze. For example, extraordinarily happy users, or that would be users who are extraordinarily happy and also using only two features out of 15, that'd be something of interest. What other edge cases do deserve like very thorough inspection of UX designers?
Two areas. The happy users are great because like if there's a happy user journey, you can find what's making them happy and you amplify that in your tool. The flip, of course, is the unhappy user. So we have a journey of somebody using software, their expectation is, you know, really high, and what they're experiencing is low. The gap between users' expectation and the current state is ripe for opportunity. So we definitely want to look at some of the, you know, negative or detractors or people that are less satisfied with the software, because there's probably some really big gains to be made there. Some happy users could be your quote unquote power users, and they're probably, you know, a minority of revenue, right? You need to have way more people who are kind of mainstream, aren't going to spend a month learning, you know, your software platform, and then they become power users. You need people that can learn it much quicker. So we already talked about kind of the newer folks are an important one. I'd say the outside of happy customers, unhappy customers is the target where our clients want to go. Who are their users now, and who do they believe they should be in the future? And that might be a smaller subset because they're just starting to, you know, prospect for those people. They're just bringing them into the tool, or they're just adding features that they think are going to appeal to them. But we really want to understand that user group, which is kind of what I would call a growth users, right? So there's happy users, there's detractors, negative users, unhappy, and then there's sort of these growth criteria. And so we definitely want to segment that out. If we have a survey and there's, you know, 100 free text forms over 3 fields, we're going to spend a little bit of time digging through those in particular, because we want to make that growth user happy for our client, because they see, you know, more revenue and sales potential there.
At what stage for a company does it make sense to start analyzing quantitative data like you do? Because at some early stages, it's clearly all about talking to individual people, getting insights at the early stage. What is that like breakthrough number to when you start measuring at scale?
I'll say I don't have a perfect metric for you, Jane. I'm sorry. Of like, this is the, this brings us over, and we start measuring. I will say this: even if you don't have statistically valid, or you have large numbers of users, even if you have 20 people using your software, querying them on a quarterly basis is a boon to your business. Yes, you're probably going to do also some qualitative research, probably going to be doing more interviews. It's easier to spend that time one-on-one. I mean, that's kind of the discovery portion and maybe validation research. And you can do that at any size, whether you have one customer or, you know, 100 people using your software. But I think once you get any sort of scale, 20 people using your software, I think you should be asking them on a quarterly basis, and maybe even on a monthly basis, just because you're so new in your life cycle. This is not an expensive proposition. I'll say that. It might be hard to tie all these numbers together and paint a true financial picture. Maybe a business will be further along to be able to do that. But what business won't succeed by having a quarterly pulse of their user satisfaction? I think any business or any software company, regardless of the stage or startup or funding, can benefit from that. Yes, if you have 5 people answering your survey, you need to caution everybody who's looking at the results that this isn't statistically valid. It's 5 out of 5 or 5 out of 20. You always should be reporting the numbers of people that responded, what your, you know, how comfortable your confidence in that data and the margin of error. And those things are easy to calculate. There's plenty of calculators out there for research. You plug in how many people responded or you want to respond versus the overall sample size. And then you can get we're 90% confident in this data, and, you know, it's a 5% margin of error. Those are usually areas where we're working. But if it's really spread out and you have a really low confidence, that's fine. You just need to let everybody know. Never present data or information that doesn't have those qualifiers around the quality of the information you're providing, because you don't want people making decisions. And as a designer, you don't want to set this expectation that because we talked to 5 out of 10 people or 5 out of 500 that we can make all of these decisions, because people will start to trust you. And if the data starts to shift in big ways, you don't want to back up and be like, well, that early data we shouldn't have listened to. So it's a good point that, you know, I think people need to be reminded, they need to be honest about the information they're presenting to people, so that even if it's low numbers and not statistically valid, it's still useful. You just need to have some caveats with it.
What's your advice to all listeners who might be, you know, solo UX consultants, for example, and they need that stakeholder buy-in to be perceived seriously, to get access to those metrics, to set up the process? And because we're often hired for that visual eye candy or a little bit of UX improvements, whatever that means. So what's your advice? And the related question is about deliverables, because that often means that the value of your work is presented in a respectable way.
Yes. I want to get back to the deliverable one. That's a fascinating conversation for me and one we've battled with as a consultancy. I mean, the solo UX team is just, it's a real challenge. And I applaud the people who are doing it out there and fighting the good fight for user-centered design within companies that might not have as much time, attention, and care for it. I mean, somebody cared enough to hire them, which is great. You know, and sometimes you're fighting a lot of battles and you're losing them. How do you have the metric conversation? It can be really hard because what might happen is the person who's hired you or brought you on or your, you know, the person you report to doesn't even have their eye on the metrics. You need to be speaking to in some way, shape, or form the people who do have their eye on the metrics. So when I'm in the sales process, one of my first questions is around metrics and measurables. And asking them, what are you currently measuring as, you know, company health and company satisfaction? Are you measuring that at the user and customer level? Most likely no. What are your goals and drivers? What are you looking at from kind of a forecasting capability? What are the metric outcomes that you want? When you ask those questions and you get, I don't know. I then shift to, well, what happened when you asked your boss about this or the C-suite? Generally, what I'm trying to do is start a conversation with them so that they're going to introduce me to the people that are thinking along those terms. So we have to be speaking to decision makers as, I mean, this is the we're talking about the business value of design and ROI. We as designers have to be talking to people who have their mind in higher level company success metrics on a day in and day out basis. And that's how we drive change in organizations. I'm not saying it's just from the metrics, but it's really hard to establish an ROI program in an organization that doesn't understand what UX is. But if you can start to speak the language, so designers have to be good at speaking to engineers, right? And I think we accept that as a battle we're going to fight, but we see it as a battle that we're going to fight that battle. We're going to talk to engineers. We're going to hopefully understand them. We're going to push against them. That's hard. But designers don't always say we're going to talk to business too. And we need to live between both of those worlds in a real way. And we need to get more comfortable talking about metrics and business metrics. So if I was a designer of one, my advice would be to educate myself on the ROI of UX and metrics, to incorporate in my process surveys and research that can start to gauge that. And to start to build a base of information that you enables that designer to have different conversations with different people. So we'll get back to deliverables in a second, but a lot of deliverables are, you know, a UI design or a production guide or a wireframe. That's a targeted deliverable at engineering and product teams that are going to go build that and support that, right? Well, if we're doing user research, we're doing a survey, that could serve a number of different constituents or audiences. Yes, it could serve product groups and engineering groups, but it could, if we do it correctly, it can serve business groups or business-minded folks or the C-suite. And so it's really about, I think, putting some of these components in place, educating ourselves as designers around what businesses care about, what are the drivers at the end of the day, and then being a part of that conversation by establishing some metrics. But I don't think it's an easy thing. I mean, I don't want to understate the amount of time and effort that'll take on top of you have 50 requests to go update these 10 or 15 screens and get it back out to engineering. You know, there might not even be the time to think about it. But if you're interested, you got to carve out that time and educate yourself and start to talk about the business side of the impact of your work. I think that shifts conversations in organizations.
If the budget or time frame or the type of client doesn't allow for research and ROI properly set up, do you turn down such projects, or have you ever done some of the best practices / like low hanging fruit kind of work? Because I've certainly done plenty. Sure. I can very well redesign something without talking to customers, which is a shame, of course. But on the other hand, it's a very cost efficient way of getting quick results. What's your take on that?
So what we will turn down at this stage in our life cycle is UI only work. So if somebody just needs it to look nicer, I think there's a lot of great freelancers out there who are super talented, and they're going to be a more affordable option. So we are looking for clients that want to move like business success metrics, and not everyone has their mind there. So there's plenty of good work which might not have the proper time allotted for user research. And so, yes, if we can apply our process and maybe do, you know, use some existing research, do some competitive landscaping and analysis, and kind of build a case internally without having to go out to users, but we can still run our process, we will do that. I mean, there's good work out there and really interesting projects. I mean, we don't turn down a lot of work, but we want to make sure that the work is a good fit for us. And so what we don't do a lot of is like marketing and communication design, you know, because that might, they might want good UX, but what they really mean is they want good UI. And so that's an easy thing for us to say, no, go find a marketing company. But, you know, if there's a process to be improved, we're happy to, you know, apply our designer brain to it and improve it the best we can. We hope that we're along the way explaining how user research and talking to customers can improve this process. And sometimes that's a multi-month or a year battle that we fight until we actually get access to it. But for two of our really big clients in the past, we were the first people to ever talk to their customers in a non-sales or support capacity. So when you're trying to sell them or you're trying to fix a problem, which are like the two worst times to talk to users, because in sales, they're going to tell you they want everything and they don't have any money, right? And then during support, they're unhappy customers. And we were the first people to talk to them right in the middle. And that was revolutionary for these organizations. And it took us, in both of those cases, maybe 6 months or a year of working with them before they allowed us to do that. Now, that was probably 7 or 8 years ago. These days, most people coming to our agency for work have an understanding that they need user research. We get asked for it more often than we don't, which I think is fortunate for us, because I'm not having to oversell research and its purpose as much as I was, you know, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. So that's a, I think that's a maturity in the industry. I think it's a maturity of our process that more people are doing it and forcing people, their companies, to do user research and actually learn from users. And people, there's a different understanding of what it means to do good UX. And I have great conversations with lots of potential clients around, yes, I know this isn't just about the UI. This is about more than that. Take me through your process of how you can translate user research into a more effective, efficient, more satisfying experience. And that's, those are great conversations to have.
Do you think that's a result of your, well, firsthand, I think we're super lucky to live in this industry age. When you said it's mature, people are rather mature in their visual design taste as well. Like the skeuomorphic health early thousands was really bad. and now we're all enjoying good taste, good UX across all products. Do you think it's your past clients' referrals that make that sort of pave the path for you forward? Or is it your writing? Or is it some other education that you're personally doing?
I mean, I think it's a combination of those. We spend a considerable amount of time creating content and material for the design community and the business community. So you'll probably find an even balance, maybe a little bit more steered towards designers on our website, our blog, and our newsletter. And we give 10 to 15% of people's time, employees' time each week to internal projects. And for a number of people, it's writing content like that because they're interested in it. And so yes, education is one core component. Our easiest sell, which is true of any business consultancy, is from previous clients who either come back for more work or they refer us to somebody else and, you know, say, hey, go work with Fuzzy Math. I mean, those are really easy sells. And generally, they aren't as concerned about process. They're concerned about outcomes. But I'll say that, you know, we've been around for a long time. And if people are looking for UX in the US, various sites, were either in Chicago, number one, top three, you know, in the US in terms of just being UX focused. So people can find us on various lists. But I'll say that the education of level of those customers coming to us who've never heard of Fuzzy Math is really high. So I think that points to a larger industry trend and the hard work that designers all over the globe are doing in terms of proper UX. And then we benefit, Ancillary have, you know, benefit of that, but we also feel like we contribute to the community as well.
As we're wrapping up today's episode, where can people find more of your writing, more of yourself personally, and your company online?
Everything about me can be found on our website. As an agency owner, you know, I pour my heart and soul into Fuzzy Math. So if people want to learn more about Fuzzy Math, go to our website, fuzzymath.com. We have a blog and a newsletter. I would encourage people to spin through a few articles. If you think they are of value, sign up for our newsletter. We don't spam people. We send out one newsletter a month. It's usually on a topic. As I mentioned, that's for designers, either new or people continuing their education or learning process. We also have some that are geared towards product engineering and kind of business teams, because again, I think we want to be at the center of conversations between business and technology and product, and so try to serve all of that on our website.
Thanks so much, Mark. This has been a great episode, and I'm sure the advice is very useful to all designers who are listening to us today.
Awesome. Thanks, Jane. Really appreciate you having me on the podcast.